So a bunch of young people go to Israel, meet with Palestinian leaders, meet with Israeli leaders. What do you think they concluded about right and wrong in the land?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So what happens when you bring a bunch of millennials over to the land of Israel? I'm talking about from different nations as well as from America. And then you sit them down with Palestinians, with Palestinian leaders who talk about the injustices they suffer, they talk about evil Israel and things like that. And then you bring them over to meet with Israelis and Israeli leaders, and they present their viewpoint, and they get to just live among these folks and hear them out. What happens? What is their impression? What is their conclusion? Is there a right? Is there a wrong? More right, more wrong. You'll be amazed to hear the results. An incredible documentary put together by the Kirk family. We'll be talking with them at the bottom of the hour. And trust me, you'll be fascinated to hear the journey and to hear the perspective of these young people being immersed in the land, these young people with a heart for justice. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Delighted to be with you. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. So during these next minutes up until the bottom of the hour, I'll be taking your Jewish-related calls. So any Jewish-related, Hebrew-related, Messianic-related question, Israel-related, by all means, give me a call, 866-34-TRUTH. Before we go to the phones, though, just some major news. I wrote an article about this right before coming up for radio. It'll be posted later today and tomorrow. The article is entitled Jews as Parasites and Jews as Termites from the Nazis to Farrakhan. So this is not up yet, just written a little while ago. Will be up shortly. Again, the title, Jews as Parasites and Jews as Termites from the Nazis to Farrakhan. If you missed it, Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, who has a history of extreme anti-Semitic comments, made a comment while speaking at a rally in Detroit. This was this past Sunday. And then he reiterated his message in a tweet. Twitter has declined to act on it. Twitter, which is infamous now for its over-censorship, for its acts against conservatives and others. One of my friends texted me the other day a perfectly legitimate tweet he sent out regarding practicing homosexuals giving blood. He gets blocked from Twitter because of that. Twitter said, no, they're going to leave this up, not going to take down the comment. So here's what Louis Farrakhan said at this meeting in Detroit. Speaking of his Jewish adversaries, he said, I can go anywhere in the world and they've heard of Farrakhan. I'm not mad at you because you're so stupid. And then he said this, when they talk about Farrakhan, call me a hater, call me anti-Semite, I'm anti-termite. I don't know nothing about hating somebody because of their religious preference. And then he tweeted this out, I'm not an anti-Semite, I'm an anti-termite. He said, well, what's so bad about that? He's saying he's not against Jews. No, he's calling Jews termites. He's likening Jews to termites. He knows exactly what he's doing because the Nazis were infamous for calling Jews parasites. They're a whole documents they put out, pamphlets they put out, educational material calling the Jews parasites, likening the Jews to parasites, books written with that mentality. Parasites suck your blood. Parasites drain you to live. Parasites are miserable. Get rid of them. What do you do with termites? You exterminate termites. Termites, the same thing. They have to eat at something else in order to survive. There's nothing good about termites. Get rid of them. So my good friend Rabbi Shmuley Boteach tweeted this out. Louis Farrakhan, calling Jews termites, is a virtual call to genocide. The Nazis regularly referred to Jews as roaches and pests who needed to be exterminated. He said, I call on African-American leaders like my close friend Cory Booker to immediately condemn this vile and loathsome attack. And it's not just Farrakhan. In my article, we note others, for example, January 2nd of this year, BBC News reported a self-proclaimed Nazi told gatherings of far-right activists that Jewish people were parasites who should be eradicated. July 28th of this year, a headline in Haaretz stated, Jews drink blood. Britain's Labour Party suspends counselor for Facebook post. And strangely enough, there is something happening, on my phone, on my cell phone. Someone took over my cell phone and tried to disrupt the show. Remarkable. July 28th, 2018, a headline in Haaretz in Israel. Jews drink blood. Britain's Labour Party suspends counselor for Facebook post. On the Facebook post, comments like this, Talmud Jews are parasites. All Talmuds need executing, obviously meaning Talmudic Jews. Last year, December 15th, 2017, Times of Israel reports a professor emeritus from an esteemed university in the Netherlands whose father was a Nazi called Jews parasites in a televised interview. And his father was a collaborator with the Nazis in charge of propaganda for a pro-Nazi party in Belgium during World War II. And according to him, Jews are not nice people. I don't feel any warmth toward them. He said they're parasites. They're speculators and mean people. You get rid of parasites. You exterminate parasites. Louis Farrakhan knew exactly what he was doing in speaking these words. Every person of conscience needs to condemn this. And non-condemnation of comments like this is what leads to the shedding of Jewish blood. Yeah, I'm not exaggerating. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to the phone starting in Alberta, Canada. Jonathan, welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Good to hear again from you. I got a question concerning Leviticus 19:19. It says, you must not crossbreed two different kinds of livestock, so your fields with two different kinds of seed, or put on garment made of two different kinds of material. And but what I find strange is that in Exodus 26, verse 1, and other passages, that the curtain of the tabernacle was made from linen and wool, and the high priest's ephod and breastplate and belt also contained wool and linen. And so I just don't know how to reconcile this. And I looked in the Stone Edition Humash, and it didn't have anything for commentary on this.
Yes, yeah, so here's something really interesting, Jonathan. Your question being, if not just in the tabernacle itself, but in the priestly garments, there were mixed fabrics, whereas Leviticus 19:19 says, do not wear clothing woven of two kinds of material. How do you reconcile these two things? Normally, the question comes up, how does this apply to today? And my explanation is that these things were laws of separation given to Israel, not to all the nations. And God was constantly teaching separation, separation. Don't sow two different kinds of seeds in your field. Here are animals that you can eat. You can't eat. Here are animals that can be acceptable for sacrifice. So there was a constant separation, separation between the holy and the unholy, between the clean and the unclean. So those things are obvious, and therefore they were didactic. They were there to teach us. But how to reconcile these things, to be perfectly candid, I have not thought of the question until you raised it here in terms of the priestly garments. I'm sure others have thought of it. So rather than fudge an answer, I'm just going to dig a little deeper and first see how the rabbinic commentaries reconcile these, how the law in Leviticus 19 was fleshed out. And then, God willing, on next week's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, if not right after the break, I will respond more fully to your question. But I don't want to give a superficial answer because I haven't thought about it before. So great job, man. Wonderful question. And I will be back to you on it soon. All right.
Well, it came up here, just reading in the Apologetics Study Bible, mm-hmm. and they were saying that there's just supposed to be a difference between the holy things and the things that are common. And they're saying that it's all right to be doing this if you're holy, but not if you're common, you're not trying to imitate the things that are holy. And it just didn't sit right with me, and I don't know how to deal with it because I don't see God being a hypocrite in any way. And so, yeah, if you could look into Rashi's commentaries or other things, or if any of your...
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of rabbinic discussion about what's called in Hebrew shatnez, which that's the mixed stuff, okay? So the question is that speaking of something different than mingling? You have part of a garment like this and part of a garment like that. What exactly is meant by it? So you have a lot of rabbinic commentary. Some of it reflects ancient tradition. Some of it is later development. Some of it is just good guesswork. But the question is, because these things were all studied side by side by side, that you have to try to reconcile them. So that's one attempt to do so. But with all respect to the notes in the Apologetic Study Bible, yeah, that doesn't satisfy me at first glance. So stay tuned. If I don't satisfy myself during the 2-minute break with an answer, we'll get back to you shortly with the answer. All right, thank you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Kim in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. My question has to do with Jesus and how he addressed Mary. He always called her woman, but he never called her mother. Now, was that the normal thing for a Jewish man to do in that day, just to address her as woman, his mother, or was it something else behind that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Why the references we have, there are just a few, like John, the second chapter, Jesus refers to his mother as woman. Now, he does, and then at other times, he makes clear that others also have a status of being part of his family, if they are part of his spiritual family. On the one hand, the same word in Hebrew or Greek that could be used for wife could be used for woman. But when it comes to mother, that's a different thing. So it is unusual. It definitely would not be the norm. And on some level, it would seem that Jesus is creating a distance, a respectful distance. He taught very strongly on the importance of honoring parents. But just like in Luke 2, where his parents are looking for him and he stays at the temple in Jerusalem, and he's interacting with the leaders there, and he says, don't you understand? I've got to be about my father's business or at my father's house. Don't you understand that? I think there's a certain level where he's making it clear, even though he is her son, he is greater than her. I mean, remember, he is also her Lord and is going to die for her sins, and she's going to bow down. She is among those who bow down and worship him. So in a respectful way, it seems to be making a distinction and putting a distance there. So it's not just a typical child-parent relationship. There's something unique to it. Hey, thank you for an excellent question. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Still playing. There we go. Turn it down. Great to be with you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thanks for joining us, 866-34-TRUTH. Of course, during the break, just looking at various lexical, so dictionary discussions of the word chatnez and what exactly does it mean in terms of mixed garments or mixed stuff, and then just starting to look at some of the rabbinic commentaries and seeing how this is reconciled with the priestly garments having mixed fabric. So, you know, I was just going through Leviticus the last few days and a number of prohibitions there. Some of them seem to be mutually contradictory. And obviously, because they're in the same book in similar contexts within a few chapters, they're obviously not. It's incoherent to think that they could be written like that and then edited like that and then preserved like that. I'm not talking about two different books written at two different times. I'm talking about similar material, obviously coming from the same time frame, the same author, and then they seem to be contradictory. So you have to dig deeper. That's what a lot of commentaries do. That's what a lot of rabbinic discussion does. And that's a lot of what we pray and think about. Okay, how do we reconcile these things? It's just like if you hear me say in the same show things that seem mutually contradictory, but you know I'm making one point, you wonder, okay, maybe there's more. Maybe I'm missing a nuance of something. So we'll We'll keep digging until we find a satisfactory answer to Jonathan's question. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Chad in Colorado. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I've been on a spiritual journey for about 2 years, which began as I was reading in Exodus, and I came to chapter 4, verse 22, where the Lord says to Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
And that got me thinking about the church in Israel. And
yeah.
So I've been reading and talking to some Messianic Jewish folks and some friends of mine, and I've come to the place now that I believe that the church has a familial relationship with Israel. Not a relationship of sameness, certainly not a relationship of supersession, but we have a relationship in the family of God with Israel. And as a Christian pastor, I want to know what you think are the responsibilities and obligations that the church has toward Israel. Since I'm a preacher, I think I'm responsible for teaching the church along these lines. Please help me.
Yeah, excellent. And I love the question, and so pleased that you're asking it. Have you read my book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood?
I have not.
Yeah, I would strongly encourage you to read that. It will really be an eye-opener in terms of church history. It will deepen your burden. It will also open up the scriptures on this even more. So here's what we do know. On the one, let's go through this in order. First, the church should be praying for the salvation of the Jewish people. That's an obvious one. As we're praying for the gospel to go to the nations, the gospel is to the Jew first. We should be praying for the salvation of the Jewish people. And we know, for example, in Isaiah 62 and in Psalm 122, the call to pray for Jerusalem. In Isaiah 62, we're not to give God any rest until he establishes Jerusalem as the praise of all the earth. That will not happen until the Jewish people welcome back the Messiah. So first thing, we pray for the salvation of the Jewish people. Second thing, there is a respect in the midst of differences because Gentile believers are grafted into the commonwealth of Israel and become part of this tree that goes back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and ultimately to the Messiah. So in Romans 11, the church is warned, Gentile believers are warned against arrogance. Don't boast against the branches. After all, you don't support the root, but the root supports you. So there should be an attitude of humility. When Martin Luther recognized how the Catholic Church had driven Jewish people away, he wrote a wonderful little book in 1523 called That Jesus Christ Was Born a Jew, a mini book saying that Jews are their elder brothers and that we are the newcomers here that have been grafted in. And perhaps if we would reach out in love, they would turn. Now, tragically, when Jewish people didn't respond as he expected and as he was old and sick and had seen some real hostile Jewish literature against Jesus, he wrote his better-known work, 1543, concerning the Jews and their lives, which called for Jews to be forbidden to teach under penalty of death and their houses, places of business torn down, destroyed, synagogues torn down and destroyed, etc., things that the Nazis put into explicit practice. So Luther started right, ended wrong. That's happened with many when it comes to Israel. So there needs to be a humility, so praying for the salvation of Israel, a humility towards Israel in the midst of differences to recognize still these are older brothers and sisters, even if they don't know the Messiah and are not in right relationship with God right now. And then a third thing would be to actively undo the history of Christian anti-Semitism by doing good and showing solidarity to Israel. So it doesn't mean that you whitewash sin. It doesn't mean that everything Israel, the Jewish people do, that everything they do is right. It means that you bless whenever you can bless, that you remember that it still does stand true. Those who bless Abraham's physical descendants will be blessed. So we pray for them. We act in humility in the midst of our theological and spiritual differences. We seek to bless Israel, recognizing that God has restored the Jewish people back to the land, even in unbelief that he's done it. So therefore, we stand with Israel. And you can do that and stand for justice at the same time. And then I would also say, to the extent you can educate your people on the ongoing purposes of God for Israel, that's very helpful. Not to try to make them Jews or to get them living like Jews or, you know, observing the seventh-day Sabbath or something like that, but rather recognizing that there is an ongoing purpose for Israel. There's an ongoing spiritual meaning to the calendar, and therefore you educate and instruct your people in those ways. I believe if you do those things, you'll be blessed and your congregation will be blessed as well.
That's great. Thank you very much. Much of that I've read and come across, and I've preached several sermons in recent months trying to convey to the church that we're not Israel, but we do live in God's kingdom with them and have some responsibilities. But I found that getting down to the application's been difficult, and this is very helpful.
Excellent.
To make sure I've got, you know, pray for salvation. I think that I suggested that we only seek to lead people to Christ once we've formed a relationship, that we shouldn't begin with that. And humility.
Yeah, and that's a goal with everyone. Obviously, there are times when it's just spontaneous and sharing the gospel, but especially with the Jewish people, because of the history of alienation, that's especially important. Yeah, so then acting with humility towards Israel, standing with and blessing Israel, and then giving your congregation an understanding of God's ongoing purposes for Israel. And again, the book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, I think will further solidify this, clarify. Hey, Chad, thank you for the excellent question and for your heart. Much, much appreciated. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Brian in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you today?
I'm blessed. Thank you.
Great, great. Listen, I got a question for you, and it kind of goes hand in hand a little bit with the last question, but when did the separation from, I guess, Moses repopulated the earth? Is that correct, after the flood?
Noah, you mean?
Moses, yeah, Noah. And when did it become separation between Jewish people and everybody else?
Yeah, so initially, God calls Abraham, then his son Isaac, then his son Jacob, because God wants to bring redemption to the world through the Messiah. So he needs a people to whom he can reveal himself and to whom the Messiah can come, and then this people can take the message of the Messiah to the nations. So in order to have this people, he needs to separate them from the nations and teach them his ways. So it begins little by little with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob recognizing that they're serving a particular God and they can't worship the gods of the surrounding peoples. And then very specifically, when God delivers Israel out of bondage in Egypt. So this is now under Moses. So about 600 years after the time of Abraham, roughly. This now is when God speaks to Israel and gives them his laws and his covenant in Mount Sinai. So starting with Abraham, there was circumcision, but other peoples practiced circumcision as well. That was not so much unique. In fact, that was widely practiced in the land of Canaan. So it was almost as if God was saying, hey, I'm connecting you to the land of Canaan. But it's with God calling Israel out of Egypt. Now he makes them a separated people. And you'll find that language directly in Exodus, the 19th chapter, where God says, although the whole earth is mine, I've brought you to myself, and you will be a peculiar treasure to me if you obey my commands. And then the laws of separation that were given to Israel were to preserve them as a nation, to teach them the ways of God, and therefore if they were preserved as a nation, as a people, they could have understanding of sin, of atonement, of the nature of God, of righteousness, of purity, and they could now learn about the Messiah when he came and be the ones to convey the message. If the Messiah came, just say, to idol worshippers in Hindu or Confucianists in you know, wherever they might have been, or Buddhists somewhere, and they would not have had a template for one true God. They wouldn't have had a template for the reality of sin and the importance of atonement and the role of the Messiah. So he takes the people, separates them for a purpose, not because they're better, but because of his love for the patriarchs. He found somebody, Abraham, that would hear his voice and obey. And then through that, calls the people, separates them. So it happens really, the clear separation, the definite separation after the Exodus, as God calls his people out, gives them the law on Mount Sinai. We come back, I'm going to speak with Daphne Kirk and her son Andrew about an amazing documentary filmed in Israel. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast today. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you with some very special guests now to talk about an important and unique documentary that was filmed in Israel. I've often commented that the younger generation, millennials, they have a great heart for justice, a great heart for equality, a great heart to stand with the victim. But often the perspective is a limited perspective. You know, when I was growing up, it was the peace movement, anti-war, and make love, not war, and that whole kind of thing. And we had some good ideals in the midst of the sin and rebellion, but our larger understanding of how society runs, and you can't just all live on a commune and get high and support a world around you, that we had certain limited understanding of things. Well, many times young people today will see what seems like an immediate injustice, but not look at the larger picture. They'll see, for example, Billy and Bobby, 16-year-old guys in high school, and they like each other, and why can't they go together if they want? Why can't they be married one day? That's not fair. Without looking, okay, what's the purpose of marriage and family and the larger issues that come out of that? Well, in the same way, many people look at Israel and say, well, the Palestinians are being mistreated. Look at this wall. Here's a wall, and these people kept out, and it's wrong. They don't look at the larger issues, the larger questions of justice. Because of that, in a zeal for justice, they may end up on the wrong side of the issue. Well, Daphne Kirk, her son Andrew, family, they've got a great ministry generation to generation. They're involved in training young people. I mean, young people, 12, 13 years old, younger, to really know the Lord and walk with the Lord and win people to the Lord and the like. And they have a great heart for Israel. And they decided to do an experiment. So we're going to talk about that now on The Line of Fire. Hey, Andrew and Daphne, are you both there with us?
We are.
We are.
Wonderful. Are you over in England right now?
Yes, we're in England right now. We head to Brazil in a couple of weeks.
All right, so I'm going to let you, whoever wants to speak, go first, whatever. You go back and forth. You take it from here. But tell us about this documentary, how you got the idea to do it, and what your actual goals were.
Well, I'm an ideas person, so I did a personality test that said I can drive people crazy with all my ideas. So I've had this idea and never mentioned it. And then I was speaking to a young person and asked him what he was passionate about. And he said, the media. And so I froze thinking, I don't know how to engage with anybody talking about the media. So I just said, well, I had a crazy idea once. How about we take young people to the Palestinian side and to Israel, meet with leaders and let them loose and see what the outcome is? And that was it. Well, the next day, his media company contacted us and said, we'll do it. Now, it so happened that they didn't end up doing it for various reasons. But at base level, we wanted to test whether what they heard in the media was true. And so we just walked into this, and the documentary is the outcome.
All right. So how did you get the young people to go over, and did you try to prejudice them in any way in advance to get a desired outcome?
No. So of the 11 young people involved, we knew three of them. The rest were either contacts through the network. We've been to over 40 nations. And we only interviewed them on Skype just to check if they could speak English well enough, if they were able to think through things clearly. And that was really it. I mean, we filmed over 3 weeks, and the three of us as the family all kept our mouths shut in terms of our own opinions and perspectives. And if one of us actually ever said something which could be slightly leading, then someone else would have to let us know that, and we would then counteract that with a perspective which balanced it out a little bit. So we really did our best to keep our mouths shut, because really this was all about the young people going on their journey and trying to figure this out for themselves.
And were you aware if the young people had preconceived ideas in coming? Did they share, this is what we think now? Or did they come in kind of blank slates themselves?
Yes, so we knew that three of them were supportive of Israel. Some of them knew about the conflict but didn't really know much about it. And then there were some that really had no clue. In fact, one of them from Japan, when people in Japan found out he was coming to be a part of it, they all said, oh, you're going to die out there. That was their idea. If you go to Israel, then you're going to a conflict and you'll die. As soon as you get there, you won't be coming home. So for the most part, they really didn't know what was happening, except for three of them who were already supportive of Israel.
Got it. All right. So let's go through this now. You want to take these young people, 11 young people from different nations, only three of whom said they were pro-Israel. You want to bring them over and you want to expose them firsthand to both sides of the conflict. You want them to meet with Palestinian individuals, man on the street kind of thing, Israeli individuals, man on the street, Palestinian leaders, government leaders, Israeli leaders, government leaders, have them sit, ask questions, and then come to a conclusion about where they stand on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Now, one thing that a lot of our American viewers and listeners may not be aware of is that the general climate in England is much less pro-Israel than in America. And even in the Church of England, the many evangelicals are not as pro-Israel as they are in America. Now, I know it was not primarily a British audience you brought, but just help us with that perspective a little bit. What do you deal with as pro-Israel Christians living in England?
Well, I think we are not representative in a way because we travel so much.
Mm-hmm.
But there is definitely replacement theology is very, very strong over here. And, of course, in the government, we have the Labour Party now, which is headed by Jeremy Corbyn, and that is overtly, I use the word pro-Palestinian in the way we usually think about it. In fact, it's quite horrifying what is going on, and there is a lot of concern amongst Jewish people living in the nation. Somebody who's on the Board of Deputies for Parliament, which represents the Jewish committee over here, Jewish people over here, said that most Jewish people are getting ready to leave. And when I said to him, well, where do you think they will leave to? He said America or Israel. So there is a lot of concern amongst the Jewish population and a lot of apathy amongst the church. But then again, there are churches that are standing strong, but it's certainly not like America.
They actually had a Labour Party conference recently. And if you go online and Google Labour Party conference, it actually looks more like a Palestinian rally. I mean, there's just flags everywhere. I mean, it's pretty wild.
Yeah. Again, your average American is not aware of what's going on. And Labour Party, I mean, you're talking about like Republican, Democrat, you got more parties than anyone, but you're talking about one of the major parties with some major leaders, among them being outspoken anti-Semites. Okay, so tell me how you structured this. What's the plan of attack? Who are they going to spend time with? How long are they going to be in Israel?
They're going to be in Israel for 3 weeks. We only had one plan of attack, and that was find the leaders and say to the leaders, would you be willing to speak to the young people and take questions? And that was the only brief we gave them. So they could talk about whatever they liked, and the young people could ask whatever they liked. And it really was a follow the clues out there. One person saying you should speak to this person, speak to this person. And so they actually stayed in the Palestinian side, and then they actually stayed in Israel and met with a whole selection of leaders.
All right. And obviously, 3 weeks is not 3 months or 3 years or a lifetime. However, these kids met with more Israeli/Palestinian leaders than I have in all my trips over, and probably met with more leaders and heard more perspective in depth from both sides than many people do who can live in the region for years and years and years and years. So as I've been, as I watched different parts of the video that you sent, I was amazed by the access they had, by the Palestinian leaders sitting down with them and Israeli military leaders sitting down with them. It was quite amazing. And it was very transparent as well. So tell us some of the folks that they met with in their 3 weeks in Israel.
Okay, so in the Palestinian side, they met with a representative from Fatah, the organization which is in control. In the West Bank, they met with governors, deputy mayors. They met with a Palestinian pastor. I mean, one of the engagements with, actually our very first interview that we did was with this representative from Fatah, and one of the youngsters from Germany saw these posters on the walls there and noticed the young boy in the poster blew up a bus that he should have been on. He missed the bus, it drove off a couple blocks and it blew up. And so suddenly he's face to face with this man from Fatah who's explaining that this boy in the poster is a member of his family. And so it's a super intense start to the documentary, but very fascinating insights to hear directly from these leaders that we hear so much about in the media. So an example would be that we heard from every single one of them about the wall or the security barrier or the apartheid wall, some people might have heard it called of. So when we went to Israel, they met with a man called Danny Terzer, and Danny is the actual architect for the entire security barrier. So they could hear from the man himself. They met with Rabbi Michael Melchior, who's been a part of a lot of the peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. They met with key Christian leaders, key Messianic leaders in the land. They met with a whole mix of people from both sides.
We have been told by Israeli diplomats, people like that, that they have tried to get access to these people and haven't been able to. And the general feedback we have had is, how did you manage to get access? How did you manage to get them to agree? Did we lie to them? And the honest truth is, no, we didn't lie. Yes, we were quite open. And our answer is, we went and asked them and they said yes. So I think they probably didn't take us seriously because we don't look like a great big media crew.
Yeah, amazingly, I'm just going to jump in. We come back. First thing, I want to let folks know where they can get this documentary, where they can watch it. But everybody did their best to present their view. I mean, you sat with the people in the thick of the conflict and people who've lost loved ones and friends, and they shared their hearts.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. If you have, well, tell you what, I'm not even going to give out the number because we are going to spend every last minute with Daphne Kirk, her son, Andrew. And by the way, if that's the most current picture of Andrew, buddy, you fit in well in a lot of places in the Middle East with that beard. You got a pretty imposing look there, too. One quick thing, just to go back to a previous question from a caller, Jonathan had called in from Canada. My best answer in the couple of little minutes just that I've had digging in a little deeper is that the specific term in Leviticus 19:19 for mixed garments is speaking of a specific type of mixture, and not to say that there can be no mixture of any kind, as in Exodus 28:6 with yarns and linen for the high priest ephod. But we'll dig a little bit further. All right, so Daphne, Andrew, if folks want to get this documentary, watch it, where's the best place to go?
First of all, that is a current picture. My Muslim friends call me Imam. My Jewish friends call me Rabbi, so it kind of works either way.
Perfect. You can actually go into Greek Orthodox circles with that, I think, or even Russian Orthodox circles. They call you, I don't know, what, patriarch or something. But go ahead.
The website is quest4truth.org. So quest4truth.org. On there, it has various tabs to follow us on the social media platforms, but there's a tab that says documentary. And we've actually provided two versions. So one is a regular version without any Christian perspectives. So if you're in high school, college, and they're not interested in that, then you can watch a regular version, you can show it to your friends, pass that around. And then there's another version, which is exactly the same, but at the end it has a bonus section giving a Christian perspective to what's going on out there.
All right, give us the website one more time.
Okay, so that's quest4truth.org. So quest4truth.org.
All right, so these young people sit with Palestinian governmental leaders. They have explained to them why, for example, you've got a swastika, that imagery in one of their hotels, things like that. You know, why this one guy tried to blow up a bus or blew up a bus, and, you know, the explanation of what he lost and what happened to him and family and so on. And sit with Israeli military, and they explain how nothing is done in some carefree way, that every bullet is accounted for, etc., and things are investigated and so on. So what did you see beginning to happen as they heard both sides, and both sides can make a very compelling presentation, but they can't be both right saying completely opposite things? What did you see begin to happen with them as they sat and listened?
Well, of course, they went on individual journeys, although, as is on the documentary, they discussed things in groups as well. So their journeys weren't all at the same pace. They went through confusion. Some of them went through just believing totally the Palestinian narrative. And we deliberately exposed them to the Palestinian narrative first because we wanted them to be steeped in it just like their peers are throughout the world. And then they came with the questions to the Israeli side. And then gradually their eyes, I think, began to open. And interestingly, at the end, their conclusions were things like they had a greater compassion for both sides. So it didn't actually turn them into hatred, but it actually gave them a compassion for the people of both sides while making definite decisions about what they believe for the leadership. So that was quite encouraging. A pivotal moment, absolute pivotal moment, was on the very last evening in the Palestinian side. We took them to a Palestinian church where Pastor Naim Khoury is, and he met with them. And one of them said to him, "What do you think of the occupation?" And his response was, "What occupation?" Now, you can watch that moment in the documentary, but yeah, it was all of a sudden, none of them knew what to think anymore.
In other words, where are the people marching down the streets? Where are the soldiers on the streets? Where are the people restricting the flow of traffic and commerce in the town?
Yeah,
right? That was right. I remember watching that. It was quite a striking comment. It's one thing if you said, look, there's control exerted over us, so we don't have equal rights, or Israelis get preference. You know, you could make that case. But when you talk about, quote, the occupation, it does present a certain image. And then he, as a Palestinian pastor who suffered much for standing with Israel, raised a major question. What happened to them after that meeting with him?
Some of them didn't know what to believe anymore, but they went immediately to the offices of an organization called Stand With Us. I don't know if you've heard of it, but they were very helpful in this process. And they went into the office, and they felt safe in the Israeli sector. And it was as if they completely unloaded, and they began to fire all these questions at some of the leaders from the Stand With Us offices. And you can actually catch that on the documentary. It was not orchestrated, but it was as if they just had to unload and fire all their emotions and feelings at these people. So it was a very authentic encounter.
Mm. And Andrew, as you were interacting with the young people, they hear the Palestinian side, so now they're caring young people, they love the Lord, they're burdened, they're concerned, there's injustice, why is Israel so hard on them, why are the Israelis so cruel? I mean, this would be a lot of what they'd be thinking. I was just at a Palestinian conference in May, and certainly you come away with that impression. Then they go over and speak with the Israelis. What was it that turned their hearts for them to realize that the narrative that they had been hearing was distorted, in some ways misleading, and virtually in every case exaggerated.
Yeah, it was a gradual thing. The fact that Naeem Khoury had questioned, and him being Palestinian himself, had questioned what they'd been told by the Palestinian leadership, that was really the start of them saying, hang on a second, things might not be as they seem to be. So it wasn't like they started to think that way because an Israeli has said that. It was because a Palestinian has started to question it. And then, as they went on this journey, this very raw, emotional encounter with the Stand With Us people, and then meeting with people like Rabbi Michael Melchior, who was able to explain more in depth about the peace process and the negotiations, when they went to the settlements. And a lot of them had heard about the settlements in the media, that they're full of criminals, for instance, that they're violent communities, that they're stealing land. And now they actually go and visit settlements, and they meet with leaders of the settlements and get to talk to them about it, but they see families and children just playing games, and they hear about football matches between the settlements and the Israelis and Palestinian football teams. They start to hear about these things going on. It's not all about this conflict. And so there's lots of little drips along the way which started to really make them question what they'd heard, number one, but also to realize, actually, we can think about the leadership of the Palestinian people, but we can also think independently of that, the average person on the Palestinian territory. And when you think about them slightly separately, you can have a love and compassion for people on both sides of this conflict.
So was there a recognition that a major reason for Palestinian suffering is not the hatred of Israelis, but the poor leadership of the Palestinians?
Yes.
Got it.
There was. Yes.
All right. One more minute. And folks, go to questfortruth.org. It's quest, the number four, questfortruth.org. Share the website, share the videos with others. Daphne, what was your ultimate goal in doing this?
To provide a resource for people in all spheres of society and in different nations, so that they can have access to this information, which is hidden in the media. And on the back end of that, if anybody is interested, we are hoping to start Quest for Truth tours where people can come themselves, meet with some of these leaders and ask their own questions, because we find in the church there is a lot of ignorance about what is going on out there today. So I would say bottom line is to provide a resource, and I encourage people who are listening to Line of Fire to go on, share the link, and start sending it to people.
And why do you think, if you can do this in 30 seconds or less, why is it so important for Christians to have an understanding of Israel?
Because it's from the beginning to the end of the Bible, and you're going to lose two-thirds of your Bible and the understanding of it if you don't engage with Israel. I'd say it that simply.
Yeah, and if much of the Bible loses its relevance and meaning to you and you don't understand the larger plan of God, friends, it will impact your own spiritual life.
Absolutely.
Daphne, Andrew, thanks so much for doing this, for all your hard work. This is a big project, took a while to carry out, and we'll point everyone we can to the website. God bless. Look forward to seeing you both again soon.
Thank you.
All right. So once more, questfortruth.org. Hey, this week, if you missed my interview with Dr. Michael Heiser, we talked about his new book, Angels. Here's a biblical Semitic scholar opening up the scriptures, what the Bible really says about the heavenly host, a fascinating read. When you get it from our website, we're packaging it with my 12-hour teaching series on angels, demons, and deliverance. Can Christians have a demon? Yeah, we talk about that too. All together on our website, AskDrBrown.org. All right, tomorrow, don't forget, you've got questions, we've got answers. Phone lines will be open and ringing for an hour solid. Be blessed.